is Steve Sherlock with another Franklin Matters radio show, number 559 in the series. This session of the radio show shares my conversation with Franklin resident and author Don Wilding. We had our conversation outdoors on the town common, albeit with some traffic and a gentle breeze, but it's June in New England, so we were able to remove the sound of the one truck that interfered. And we had a pleasant talk about Don's story, living in different parts of the Hockomock area, and now here in Franklin. It was exciting to be in person, my second time for a recording this year. We get into Don's recent book, Shipwrecks of Cape Cod. He's out on a lecture circuit of sorts with a presentation on this book. Our conversation runs about 33 minutes, so let's listen to my conversation with Don Wilding. Steve Sherlock here for Franklin Matters, Franklin Public Radio, anywhere on the internet at WFPR.FM and in the local area dial at 102.9. Here today on the Town Common, yes, we are outdoor, albeit socially distanced but maskless, in this wonderful array of greenness on the Common in the beginning of June with yep. Don Wilding, Franklin author, although a recent Franklin vintage, but certainly longtime New Englandite. And with a book on Cape Cod and the shipwrecks of Cape Cod. Don, thanks for taking time to talk with us today.
Hey, thanks for having me, Steve. Yeah, long time connection to this area, although it's the Cape Cod thing. I actually go back in this general area almost 40 years.
Okay.
I'm originally from New Jersey, but I've lived everywhere, Stoughton, Easton, Foxborough, Mansfield, North Attleboro. Lived on the Cape for a while, and now I'm back living in this area as my primary residence.
Okay.
Here in Franklin. I've been here since November of 2020.
But
I've been going in and out of Franklin for almost 40 years.
Right. And I think some of that was, as we were talking before recording, you were in news as well. So you were different newspapers and doing reporting and coverage, and Franklin is sometimes in the news.
Yes, oh, absolutely. And, you know, I was in a lot of what you would call, people around here would know, Hockomock League towns.
League, yes.
And so the newspapers I worked for were mostly the Mansfield News, the Foxborough Reporter, where I was the sports editor, also in Mansfield as well, and the Sharon Advocate, and for a short time, the Country Gazette here in Franklin.
Right.
That was probably about 30 years ago now. And also the Sun Chronicle, where I didn't really do so much sports, but I was a news editor, also entertainment editor for a spell. So yeah, my connection to here goes back quite a ways. I spent many hours at the Franklin High Field House for track meets, basketball games, wrestling meets, because Foxborough and Franklin often
were
head-to-head, top of the Hockomock, as far as wrestling was concerned, also track. So, yeah, it was, I've come through here quite a bit.
Yeah, it was interesting, too. You met the Franklin High tennis team beat Sharon, boys Sharon, beat them for the first time in 50 years.
I remember that streak that Sharon had, too, which seemed, I forget how many wins in a row that Sharon had in the league, and I think it was broken by Canton, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
But that goes, that went back for, it was 200 and something, I think. I can't even remember at this point. But yeah, some really impressive athletic contests and athletes that have come through this area,
Hockomock League is certainly very big. I leverage the HockomockSports.com for the sports reporting that I share through Franklin Matters to the Franklin folks.
And
they've been an invaluable resource to get really into the detail across the entire league. That's been wonderful. And then across the entire league, working with the various cable organizations for people during the pandemic, if they wanted to go see their high school or soccer or hockey or whatever, the host cable town would broadcast and then make the live feed available for the other towns, because during the pandemic you didn't have spectators, or you had limited, one per. So at least with the live feeds and the live stream, a lot of the games in varsity at least were available. And then some of the parents I was finding were doing
the JV and the freshmen, so those could get added as well.
Yeah, and that whole cable coverage goes back years. I mean, I can remember sitting in as a commentator or even a play-by-play announcer during the 80s, in Easton and Mansfield, Norton, for basketball and baseball and thing and football and things like that. And it's come a long way. It really has. I mean, it was never live in those days.
No.
That was unheard of.
Yeah.
You know, now, but I guess the pandemic brought about some good things.
Yes. Yeah, one of the hidden lines, the silver linings within it that has helped. Yes, for sure. For sure. So our primary focus today is your new book, Shipwrecks of Cape Cod. And I picked it up on the radar because you did a presentation, I believe, through the Senior Center. And from what I've been seeing, you've been doing a fairly good number of them with different libraries, different other organizations, primarily via Zoom. But I'm sure as things open up, you'll start getting to some of those in person as well.
Yeah. Actually, these presentations go back 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Even when I was still working for the newspapers, in between ball games, I'd be looking up Cape Cod history information, various research, and it really has grown. It went from one thing to another gradually. It was a slow change going out of sports and then out of newspapers and now completely into this. It's my third book. My first one was a book called Henry Beston's Cape Cod, How the Outermost House Inspired a National Seashore. And a few years ago, I wrote a book called A Brief History of East Ham on the Outer Beach of Cape Cod. And this is my third. And this book kind of, I guess it all grew out of Henry Beston's book, The Outermost House.
Kind of the starting point there.
Yeah, because, I read that back in the 90s. And that's the greatest book I've ever read, far and away.
Mm-hmm.
And Beston's command of the English language and his prose and his descriptions of Cape Cod's outer beach, which I was always fascinated by.
Sure.
And he covered a lot of different subjects, and not just nature and the geography and everything about the Cape, but also the history of the Cape, whether it was in East Ham, which has an extensive history in itself. That was the location of the first meeting between Pilgrims and the Nossets at First Encounter Beach, who they call it now. And but also the shipwrecks get great descriptions by Beston in that book, and I was fascinated by that. And I've always found that when I was researching anything about Beston, it kind of and Cape Cod, it always came back to the shipwrecks.
There's
so many of them, because when you look at the history of Cape Cod and that outer beach, treacherous area for people at sea, for navigators, for mariners. And between 1626 and the mid-20th century, there were somewhere between 3,000 and 4,000 shipwrecks.
Shipwrecks. That's a lot of shipwrecks.
It was unbelievable. It's been said, it's an old saying, that if you could raise every one of these shipwrecks up, you could walk from Provincetown to Chatham without getting your feet wet.
Wow. Yes.
So that's
a lot.
That's a long time, too.
Sure.
And all this that happened, there's a lot of unbelievable stories behind it. I mean, it's impossible to find everything.
Right.
I mean, I could work on this for the next 50 years.
Yeah.
I won't be around that long. But still, it's something that you could keep working on and you still won't find every little bit of information.
Sure. Yeah.
But I've managed to find, for this book, I zoomed in sort of on 43 different disasters.
Okay.
And I stayed away from some of the better known ones, like
the more popular ones.
The Whydah, and the Pendleton, which was the focus of The Finest Hours.
Okay. Yeah.
And those two books were very well known.
Sure.
And so I stayed away from those well known ones.
Yeah.
But there were so many other intriguing stories and stories of heroism.
Yes.
Really, with when it came to the Coast Guard and its predecessor, the U.S. Life Saving Service.
Sure.
Which the stories of bravery, it's just amazing. It was actually something Henry Beston was fascinated by when he first went to the beach and saw all this happening.
Yeah.
Because he got to know the men of the, by that time it was the Coast Guard. And Beston had been in the First World War as a ambulance driver, stretcher bearer for the American Field Service. Saw the worst of the worst in outside of Paris and in France during the war, Battle of Verdun. And when Beston finally came back to the States, this is when it all really set in with him.
Sure.
You know, and he had seen all this horror and people, you know, losing their lives right in front of him.
Yeah.
But then he saw what was going on the outer beach, the work of the Life Saving Service and the Coast Guard, the surfmen who patrolled the outer beach at that time. And he was really, he really admired what these men were doing and really heartened by it.
Right.
So it's, you know, I kind of went on from that, you know, being equally fascinated by the stories of what these men had to face.
Yeah.
Too, some really horrible stuff.
Anybody who's been in and around here in New England knows the power of a New England storm. So now put that on the beach and the waves, etc. And now you've got people going in little like lifeboats and, you know, small craft to go help somebody who's on a ship that's wrecked and sinking. And they're truly getting into a dangerous situation because that vessel is not necessarily in a stable position for them to make some rescues.
It never was, because these always happen during storms.
Right.
And at that time, particularly late 1800s, early 1900s is where I really focused on, because that's when the greatest amount of recorded disasters were happening.
Sure.
And there was no Cape Cod Canal at that time.
Right.
So you had to navigate, especially commerce was usually, a lot of it was by sea at that time. So it went between, going between Boston and New York, or even coming from overseas.
Sure.
You had to work your way into Massachusetts Bay.
Yeah, get around that.
Getting around
Provincetown.
Around Provincetown, the area known as Race Point. Well, they call it the Race for a reason.
The Race
because
for a
of
reason.
The currents.
Yeah.
And also down around Chatham. Monomoy Island, really treacherous area.
Yeah.
In fact, the Mayflower was almost a shipwreck victim.
Mm-hmm.
When the separatists first set sail and were headed for this land at the time.
The New World.
The New World. They were actually heading for the Virginia colony.
Yeah.
At that time, I think what it was actually New York.
Yeah.
So they were blown off course by a lot of storms coming across the ocean. They finally sighted land. That land was East Ham that they saw.
Mm-hmm.
And from maps that they already had, that had been charted by none other than Captain John Smith of the Virginia colony, when he was up here in 1614, they knew where they were. And they knew they were way off course. So they started to head south. Well, that's when they hit those shoals of Monomoy, right off of Chatham, what's now Chatham. And they had to turn around. There was no getting around it. And the wind also at that point was at their favor. They managed to go back up the coast and settled into what is now Provincetown Harbor. According to Smith's map, it was called Milford Haven.
Okay.
And then they explored the Outer Cape and eventually settled in Plymouth about 6 weeks later.
Sure.
But that's another story in
that's
itself.
Story.
But they almost became the first shipwreck.
Yeah.
And so everything happening there, plus you've got shifting sands offshore, which are treacherous. It just, you could sail past a certain area, be even not even a mile offshore, and the way the sands were a few days before would not be the same as it was this on this given day.
Sure.
So this is what they were up against, and just when storms came along, Before the early 1800s, there wasn't much in the way of lighthouses even.
Correct.
Highland Light wasn't built until 1797.
Yep.
And then you had the, there were two lights actually at Chatham, 1815, I believe it was. And then the Three Sisters of Nauset were built in 1837.
Yeah.
So that's, you started to get some help. But,
some navigational help.
But even
still,
then,
that's a long stretch with only a few points of contact.
Sure. And there wasn't too many, there wasn't much in the way of help either.
Right.
When a ship did run aground, as they called it,
because
it would hit the sandbar. And when it hit the sandbar, it wasn't just the getting stuck in the sand.
No.
It shook it. It just messes it up. It shatters the ship.
Yeah.
And then you have it getting pounded by waves, and then the men have to climb up in the masts. And a lot of times they met their end that way in various ways. So it was a very dangerous situation. So the surfmen from each of these stations, there were nine originally, started by the Life Saving Service in 1872. Nine stations grew to 13 stations from Woodend in Provincetown all the way down to Monomoy Point at the end of Monomoy Island, south of Chatham.
Yeah.
And this was the way it was from the late 1800s going into the 1920s, 1930s, because at that point that's when the canal came along.
Right.
And technology was also starting to improve.
Sure.
But they would have, at each one of these stations, there would be a keeper who was, or referred to as captain, but he was in charge. And they would also have anywhere between seven and nine surfmen who were, their job mostly was to patrol the beaches at night. And this happened between August and June. Summers they kind of had off. They only had a couple of people on duty because there wasn't as much need unless a hurricane came by.
Right.
But otherwise, they were they would patrol the beach every night. They would send one guy south, one guy north. These guys would cover a lot of ground.
Yeah.
And
just
they would be wearing,
watching and listening.
Watching, listening. They would carry a lantern sometimes. They'd wear oil skins, especially in bad weather.
Yeah.
And they carried also what they called a Coston flare.
Okay.
Which was basically your road, you know, what you would use on the road now for a flare.
Sure.
But it would be to, they would hold it up if they saw a shipwreck. And this was, served two functions. It would be to notify the people on board the ship if they were still alive.
If they were observing. Yeah.
And, or were able to function at all.
Sure.
That help was on the way.
Yeah.
And it also was a signal back to their station, because each station had a tower where they had somebody on watch. And if they saw that flare, they knew, okay, we got to get the apparatus cart ready. And this, sometimes the apparatus cart was basically a big wagon on wheels.
Sure.
And with all kinds of equipment that they needed. And it consisted of a small cannon called a Lyle gun, also a box full of rope that was about 500 yards worth of rope.
Yeah, long rope.
Long rope, projectiles.
Yeah.
And they also had a surf boat. And it depended on the condition of the surf.
Mm-hmm.
As to, this was just among some of the stuff they had.
Yeah.
And if the surf was not too treacherous, they would attempt a surf boat rescue.
Okay.
And sometimes that worked. Sometimes it didn't. They would get in the surf boat and everybody would be
deep
spilled
six.
Over.
Yeah. Yeah.
And other times they knew they couldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, that's when they would use the Lyle gun. And they utilized something called the breeches buoy. And some folks may have seen at Race Point during the summer, one night a week, they would have these demonstrations of how it actually worked, the reenactments.
Yep.
So the breeches buoy was really quite a marvel. It created a zip line between the beach and the ship.
The vessel,
Put the projectile in this Lyle gun, named after a captain named David Lyle, who invented it. And they would fire it with the projectile and the rope, and it would go all the way to the ship. If their shot was good, they'd have to attempt it several times.
Good aim.
And they would have to fire it over the mast.
Yep.
And hopefully somebody on board could take it, fasten it.
Sure.
And then they would have this line, And on the end of it was a very unusual item. It was like a pair of pants that you would step into, and you were going to ride on this thing back to shore. They'd have to do one at a time.
So it's kind of a built-in harness, but you just slept into the pants.
Yes,
and then
exactly.
Take a zip line.
And then you load the zip line back, and hopefully some wave didn't come along and take
you
away.
The other way.
Because there'd be 20, 30-foot waves coming in sometimes.
Yep.
So it was really treacherous, and sometimes people didn't make it that way either, but that saved a lot of lives.
Mm-hmm.
So that was their job, and a lot of, not only did people board the ships meet their end, even despite the rescue attempts, also some of the surfmen did too.
The rescuers, yeah.
And it was a dangerous job.
Sure.
And it paid somewhere between, it depends when, but it was something like $40 to $60 a month. You know, so it was, no job was paying a lot in those days, especially on Cape Cod.
Correct.
That was actually pretty good work if you could get it.
Yeah.
And the keepers, of course, made substantially more, but nobody had, there were no benefits or anything.
That was pre-benefits anyway, I think.
they were able to finally work it in when it became the Coast Guard in 1915. The life-saving service was under the direction of a gentleman named Sumner Kimball. And Kimball was originally a Maine native, but he had actually taught school in Orleans in his young adult life. So he knew the Cape, and he knew all the things about shipwrecks. So he was in charge of the whole operation.
Mm-hmm.
And Kimball was the ultimate bureaucrat. He knew how to get money out of Congress. he even hired a writer to be his, to file the reports, who would kind of dress it up a little bit and make it look good. So he got his money from Congress, and he was also the first person in the life-saving service to draw a pension.
Oh.
So, and eventually they were able to do that. But if somebody became horribly injured on the job, which happened a lot, they were out of luck.
No pension.
You were sent on your way.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it, because you had to have some physical capabilities to do the job.
Right.
And you also had to have a lot of know-how. There was a lot of training involved.
Yeah.
And a lot of people didn't stick with it.
Mm-hmm.
There were some people who said, went with it for a few months, a year, and they said, I've had enough of this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like taking my life in my hands every time I, you know, go out. And they would walk the beach, and some of the really horrible things, besides a wave could come and take you at any time.
Sure.
There was also what they referred to as the sand.
The sand.
Because the sand was always blowing.
Yeah.
And when the sand blows during a 50-mile-an-hour gale, it stinks.
Yeah.
Guys would come back. There were stories of from the Portland gale storm of 1898, where they came back to the station for 80, 90-mile-an-hour winds during that storm, and their faces were bleeding.
Pockmarked.
From the sand being stinging their faces. They came back, their blood-soaked faces from that. So it was a hard job. It was not one I don't think I would have wanted. It's tough enough. If anybody who's nowadays, who's ever gone out there and walked the beach just during a storm, a 50-mile-an-hour storm, say, you can get a taste of what that was like. And then you're carrying all this equipment, and then you have to go in the water.
Yes.
No thanks.
Yeah.
You know, tough going.
And those were days before the nice, sophisticated wetsuits, which at least would help the body keep the temps. Those were not those days.
No, they didn't. That was tough. And as technology improved in the 1920s, 30s, and gradually improved, there was a need for less and less, and along, of course, the canal, too, coming along.
More traffic the other way.
Finalized in the 1930s to what it is now. It became, you didn't need as many stations anymore.
Yeah.
So now you go to the Outer Cape, there's only a few stations, Coast Guard stations out there. You've got Provincetown, and you've got Chatham.
Yep.
That's pretty much it.
Yeah.
You know, everything in between is either old relics, or you've got the old Cahoon's Hollow Station, which is now the Beachcomber Nightclub.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a different different world now,
mm-hmm.
as far as that's concerned.
Indeed. So obviously people can purchase your book, like I just did, so I'm going to be able to have some reading material to do, to follow up and get into the details of the story. And you've got the presentations and schedule, and your website will include in the show notes so people can follow that. If they were going to the Cape and wanted to check a site or two, a couple of key points to point them in the direction for visiting today, to go back into this was once upon a time.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's several that you can go to. Unfortunately, with Coast Guard stations, life-saving stations, there aren't too many of them left.
Sure, right.
There's some interesting places, and when it's open, it's really interesting. Its hours are kind of limited. Is the Old Harbor Life-Saving Station up at Provincetown.
Okay.
It's at Race Point.
Yep.
At Race Point Beach. And if you go up there, you see this old-fashioned life-saving station on the sand on the way to the walk down to the beach. And it's a museum now.
Okay.
A tribute to the Coast Guard and life-saving, particularly the life-saving service. And that's where they hold those breeches buoy demonstrations on occasion.
Sure.
But that station was built in Chatham in 1897 following the wreck of the Orcutt. Was the name of the vessel.
Okay.
And after that, they determined that a station was needed on North Beach in Chatham because there was nothing between the 9-mile stretch between Orleans and the Chatham station.
Right.
So they determined after this deadly disaster, we need to build a station here. Well, they did. It was the Old Harbor Station. And that was there, that was built in 1897. And there was about 600 feet of sand between the station and the high water mark of the waves coming in. Well, fast forward to the 1970s. By this time, the station's still there, out of use, but people wanted to preserve it.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, they couldn't because it was not going to be there for long.
Right.
The waves were coming within 10 feet of the dock.
Oh.
And so in November of 1977, right after Thanksgiving, they cut up the station, put it on a barge, and floated it up to Provincetown.
Oh, okay.
And it actually sat in Provincetown Harbor over the winter.
Yeah.
And eventually was put up at Race Point, reconstructed, and it's there now. Okay. The thing was, when it was moved in November of 77, a little over 2 months later was the infamous blizzard of 1978.
Oh, yes.
Which up here, we all remember it being buried in 3 feet of snow, or 10-foot, 12-foot snow drifts.
Sure.
Maybe even more.
Yep.
And, well, down on the Cape, that wasn't the case. It wasn't really a snow event. It was more of a tidal event.
Tidal.
You had hurricane force winds, along with this abnormally high tide because it was a new moon.
Sure.
So that just caused incredible flooding. It's what took out Henry Beston's outermost house and several other beach camps. But it also overran the area and whatever had been left of the Old Harbor Life-Saving Station. The old sheds and stuff they had there were destroyed. And the station itself would have been destroyed had it not been for that.
Right.
So that was really quite a
timely maneuver.
Great maneuver, and it's a really great place to see what it was like.
Yeah.
You know, because the old equipment is there, and when they do have the breeches buoy demonstration, they actually have to have somebody who's certified to fire that cannon.
Right.
So that's tough to come upon too, I guess.
Sure.
So that's an interesting place you can go. To see what it was really like. Coast Guard Beach, you can also see a remnant in Eastham of what it was like, too, back in the day. Although that beach has changed substantially because of what happened in 78.
Right.
There is an old Coast Guard station there that's used for, they refer to it as an education center for the National Seashore.
Yeah.
It was the Coast Guard. It was built in 1935. The old Nauset Station is long gone. And I mentioned the Beachcomber Nightclub,
right?
Also a relic of days gone by. A lot of other places, though, if you want to see where stations were, you might find a few relics up at High Head in North Truro. There's still some foundation pieces of that station mm-hmm. in the sand.
Yeah.
But there isn't too much, not a lot else. And also mm-hmm. you've got the old lighthouses.
Right.
Highland sure. Light, which has been renovated yeah. over recent years. Nauset Light,
yeah.
Which used to be in Chatham, by the way, and was moved up to East Ham in 1923.
Yeah.
And right up the road from that, you can still see the second set of Three Sisters lighthouses, which are in a little park right a few steps down from Nauset High School.
Okay.
So there's those old relics as well.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the parts are still there.
Yeah. For those who want to or regularly visit the Cape, there's plenty to do there, just in addition to the walking along the National Seashore, which clearly is still changing with the climate and the weather, et cetera, these days.
Oh, every day it's different.
Yeah.
If you go to Coast Guard Beach now, mm-hmm. the entrance that you used to get there in recent years, it's different now.
Yeah.
The old one up next to the Coast Guard station has been closed off because there's so much erosion.
Right.
They moved it down the road there a little bit to the north, and you have to go in to the beach that way. Mm-hmm. That's going to be one surprise to a lot of people.
Yeah.
And there's a few others as well. The erosion is constantly there.
Yeah.
And eventually, you know, houses have to be moved. Yep. Or they fall in.
Sure.
That's happened on many occasions. Yep. Nauset Light, 3 years ago, there was a big storm. When we had those high tides in March that
okay.
year,
yep.
there was one house that had been close to the edge for a long time, and then it was so close, they eventually had to dismantle the house mm-hmm. before it fell in.
Yeah.
So you're living on borrowed time.
Yeah.
When you build on over by the ocean.
The ocean front.
Like that.
Yeah. The earth is continuing to evolve.
So true.
With the weather to it. Well, thank you for your taking time today. I'm sure we could probably continue for an hour or more. There's so many more stories, but we'll just tease the listeners that perhaps we can do this again and focus on a couple of other stories in the archives. And
yeah, I'd be glad to. There's so many stories of that and other items of Cape Cod history mm-hmm. as well. So.
Yeah. And is there another book beyond this at some point?
Yeah I was going to expand on this a little bit. Originally, I was going to include something on the Portland Gale of 1898
okay.
in this book. And then I got to the point where it was just such an overwhelmingly huge chapter, it started to grow on its own.
Okay.
And now it's got the makings of a book of its own.
So standalone of its
that
own.
Storm is phenomenal. It was, you had almost 200 people perished on the SS Portland alone,
mm-hmm.
And then, which was a huge steamship at that time,
yep.
During that storm of Thanksgiving weekend of 1898, and plus you had a lot of other wrecks. You had 450 plus people died during that disaster. It's the greatest maritime disaster in New England history.
Wow. Clearly before many of our times, and
oh,
I'm sure
absolutely.
Those stories have never gotten passed down, which is why it gives you an opportunity to do that research of what sources are there
especially
available
and
the report it. Yeah.
Especially on the Cape, because that's a well-known story, but the Cape had its own chapter of mm-hmm. what happened during that storm,
sure.
and it was frantic, it was madness yeah. down there for several weeks after yeah. that storm.
Indeed. Good. Well, thank you again. And for all the listeners, I hope you enjoy. Pick up a copy of Shipwrecks of Cape Cod. And the link to the book, to Don's page, will be in the show notes. So thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
We are now producing this in collaboration with Franklin TV and Franklin Public Radio. This podcast is my public service effort for Franklin, but we can't do it alone. We can always use your help. How can you help? If you can use the information that you find here, please tell your friends and neighbors. If you don't like something here, please let me know. Through this feedback loop, we can continue to make improvements. And I thank you for listening. For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.org. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com. The music for the intro and exit was provided by Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is titled Ernesto Mañana, copyright Michael Clark and Tintype Tunes in 2008, and used with their permission. I hope you enjoy. By the way, you can also subscribe and listen to Franklin Matters Radio on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Search in podcasts for Franklin Matters.